This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Last week, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed the US Congress. The visit was controversial because it was done at the invitation of the Speaker, bypassing the White House. Facing an upcoming election, the Israeli Prime Minister not only burnished his credentials as a tough-talking leader, but also attacked American diplomatic moves with Iran. How has the Prime Minister of Israel come to feel he has so much say over American foreign policy? Binoy Kampmark is senior lecturer at RMIT University in Australia. We asked him how he would characterize the relationship between the two countries.
Yeah, well, the situation between the United States and Israel is that over the years, so essentially since the creation of the State of Israel, of which the United States was a significant player in, has developed to the point where it's become very close. The relationship centers on a considerable amount of aid in the form of billions. In fact, Israel is one of the greatest recipients of U.S. assistance, be it economic, be it military, be it in security and so forth. And so there's a lot of cooperation that takes place between Israel and the United States. And of course, the United States is Israel's greatest backer when it comes to the Security Council, the United Nations Security Council. And that's one of the reasons why resolutions that are submitted by other countries for discussion tend to be defeated, because the Israelis always know that they have a backer, as it were, in the form of Washington's guidance.
Is the extraordinary support that the U.S. gives to Israel done for strategic geopolitical reasons, or is it based on a common ideology and worldview?
Oh, it's a combination of those things you outlined. It is certainly ideological in the sense that there is a perception that Israel is this jewel of democratic progress in a sea of tyrannical regimes. This has been a motif for a very long time, this idea that Israel is somehow the progressive regime and that all others in the region, in the Middle East and in North Africa, are somehow degenerate authoritarian regimes. But of course, the problem with that characterization came out when the Arab Spring started, and it suddenly was, Israeli diplomacy was hell-bent on preventing regimes otherwise deemed authoritarian from being overthrown. So you had a very strange dynamic that was at play there. So one is the ideological feature, and the other, of course, is very much a strategic feature, too. It's the idea that Israel also keeps other regimes in the Middle East in check, even though it can be quite a dangerous ploy, as is evidenced by, of course, Israel's refusal to even entertain the notion that other countries in the area might have nuclear potential, and I'm not even talking about a military potential, I'm just talking about a civilian potential.
It's worth noting that at one point in American history, anti-Semitism was rife, with the famous instance of tycoon Henry Ford supporting the fictional anti-Semitic tract called The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. But attitudes have changed. We asked how important the right-wing Christian lobby is to the political support for Israel.
You point out the very interesting historical transformation from an individual of such clout as Henry Ford, believing essentially traditional anti-Semitism in that particular line, in that particular view, to a concerted political union between the Christian right, the evangelical right more specifically in the United States, and the interest with Israel. It's not even necessarily that these individuals believe that international Jewry or the Jews of Israel are fated in a specific way, but they do see them as custodians of essentially the Holy Land. They see them as custodians for the Second Coming, which is one of those curious things because, of course, Judaism doesn't accept that there was even a First Coming, let alone a Second Coming in the Christian context. But it's a political convergence that reached the point you could even say a form of a holy union during the 1980s when Ronald Reagan managed to bring the evangelical and Christian right into the Republican foray. So a range of Republican figures and political figures, and he also brought individuals of the Billy Graham mold and of the evangelical mold who do, of course, see Israel as indispensable to their religious vision. So that's one of the reasons why it figures very strongly in narratives from the Christian right in the United States.
One expression of Israel's influence in Washington is the lobby group calling itself the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or IPAC.
Yes. AIPAC is a significant lobby group in the United States that's been the subject of some criticism by individuals who have argued for some time that the relationship with Israel is distorting to the prism of U.S. foreign policy. They argue that organizations like AIPAC, for example, constitute a very influential and a disproportionately influential presence in Washington in terms of interest towards Israel and so forth. And so, that's one of the reasons why it has been said that when Israeli presidents, or prime ministers rather, when they do visit the United States, they're given a superstar welcome. They're given a particular welcome that they just would not themselves, of course, receive in Israel. It's almost mandatory for every Israeli leader of any substance when he or she travels to the United States to pay a visit to AIPAC. And of course, there was no exception here regarding Benjamin Netanyahu's visit.
Binoy notes that part of the Israeli prime minister's purpose was naked populism for domestic consumption ahead of polls there. And on the Republican side, the visit is part of the speaker's stated desire to be a thorn in the Obama administration. While many Democrats did not attend the speech, Binoy points to Netanyahu's dangerous ploy.
Yes, it's the fundamental point, and it's a very dangerous ploy, because what it does is it boxes in advance any approach to the situation of Iran and its nuclear capabilities and ambitions and aspirations. Netanyahu's period seems to be staked upon is this idea that under no circumstances will Iran, or for that matter any other regional power, obtain a nuclear potential. And I'm not even talking about a military one, I'm talking about even civilian infrastructure, because they're suspicious, of course, that any civilian infrastructure will enable Iran to go into a military development program very quickly. But it's important to note that this has been the Netanyahu fascination for some years now. He can't change the subject. He is constantly fascinated by what he terms the murderous mullahs in Tehran. He is obsessed by the supposed inherent anti-Semitism of the leaders. And he keeps talking about essentially that Israel is on their list of countries to eliminate and so on and so forth. And it's not a very convincing argument, because of course what he's suggesting to everybody else is don't negotiate with Iran, walk away, let them collapse, or let them actually, and if they do get a weapon, we of course bomb them. It's not a very constructive view, and that's one of the reasons why situations between Israel and Washington, certainly the White House, are rather tense at this point, because they demonstrate different worldviews as to how Iran and the nuclear problem is to be dealt with.
But has Israel been able to persuade the American public that it's under constant threat of destruction and therefore justified in its preemptive wars, extension of settlements, and other such forms of aggression?
There is a general common narrative here that has been accepted, and it is accepted. Even, for example, the Democrat leader Nancy Pelosi, who did not listen and rejected the position taken by Netanyahu's, Netanyahu's very firm position against Iran. She, for example, spoke about how she had tears in her eyes when she was listening to the speech, and then on the other hand, she acknowledged that Israel is a very close friend of the United States, but that negotiations with Iran, albeit imperfect and leading to an agreement, were necessary. You could not isolate and exclude Iran from these arrangements, because that was a far more dangerous path. So there is an understanding, there is a consensus on one thing. None of those individuals in Congress want or accept the idea that Iran could develop a nuclear weapon, or they don't want that to happen. The question is how they go about doing it, and there seems to be a very open split in terms of a heavier line, be it sanctions, be it excluding or rendering Iran isolated on the one hand, but also incorporating it in some arrangement with monitoring that will prevent proliferation. So these are the visions that seem to be playing out in terms of the Israeli-U.S. relationship at the moment.
Finally, we asked if the United States could ever be an honest broker in the conflicts in the Middle East.
It's very difficult for it to ever be an honest broker. A broker, yes. An honest one, no. And the reason is simple, because the United States has so much power and finance invested in, for example, the Israeli state. It sees its interests as connected with Israel, and it would never do anything, if you like, that would push that particular relationship to the brink. I mean, it's are very cool at the moment, and it's probably as cool as it has been for decades at the moment between Israel and the United States. But notwithstanding that, you know, there is still an understanding in Israel at the end of the day that the United States is going to be there backing them. And that, you know, unfortunately means that in any peace negotiation or in any situation where there are disagreements between Israel and other powers in the Middle East, there's always going to be a compromise situation. And that's something I just see persisting until or unless the Washington establishment and the White House start reevaluating the way they see the position in the Middle East.
That was Benoit Capmark, a regular contributor to the news analysis portal counterpunch.org. He's also a senior lecturer at the School of Global Urban and Social Studies at RMIT in Australia. I'm Sharad Kutin, reporting for BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.